Morning. So last time, it does work, we talked a lot about condition codes in x86. We learned that wasn't the case that our conditional jump instructions needed to have a compare instruction just before. And in fact, those compare instructions were setting these special registers, just a couple of bits of information that those instructions used. And those registers were also set by almost all arithmetic operations, just based on what the result was, sort of remembering the information you needed in order to do less than, greater than, all the comparisons we expect from our conditional jump operations. So then we started talking about some C things, just reviewed what the types in C are, mentioned what the machines will be using, what the sizes were, talked about how Booleans work in C and how that's different than what you were probably used to or would expect from C++ and Java, and reviewed a bit about pointers and kind of talked about pointer arithmetic, the idea that when we have array indexing in C, that really we're manipulating pointers by adding to them. And there's these two syntaxes which are exactly equivalent. And we had a brief interlude at the end talking about some tips for using command lines. So before I move on, any questions about what we talked about last time? Okay, so I mentioned in our first day of class that we would have quizzes, and they will start after this week. There will be a quiz on the reading for next week. And there's some logistics to do with that, so where are you going to take the quiz? We have a web interface, which let me make sure I'm displaying it right here, which looks like this, except yours will have different quizzes on it, which won't be called example quiz 1, 2, and 3. You can get to this from the course website from this link. When you have a quiz, you'll see there's an open date and a closed date, and there's a time limit. So once you start the quiz, you have the time limit. If you have SDoc accommodations, you have the time limit as modified by any SDoc accommodations that I am aware of, and you can take the quiz. So if you take this quiz here, I open this up. It asks me if I really want to do it because that starts the timer, and we know people don't like having that happen by accident. And you'll get an interface like this. You can enter answers. And when things are working correctly, which apparently they aren't, it will not be yellow and red like that. This is what I get for not setting up my demo quiz website. So let's try this again. So when it works correctly, it will turn green. If it turns yellow and red, something is wrong. Tell us about it. We will fix it. And when it turns green, the answer is recorded. If it stays yellow with a red line around it, it is not. This could mean you're not logged into NetBadge or something is wrong in our server. So once it's green, the answers are recorded. There's a place to put comments in. We will have someone eventually read these comments and adjust your score accordingly. If your comment suggests that you knew it was going wrong but had a weird interpretation of the question, we will give you credit. If your comment suggests that you may have answered it partially correct, but your comment shows that you didn't understand the topic at all, we might lose you credit. But we will have someone read through them eventually. But for the first pass, these will be auto-graded. So if we go back here, I have, you won't see the grader site link, but I have, if you go to the quiz that's complete, we have the actual scores and when work, I think. So we have the actual scores I got, which is auto graded, and we have these percentages here. Because this is not a real live quiz, they're all not a number percent. On the real quizzes, there will be the percent of students who answered each answer. So you can see like what your classmates thought. That doesn't tell you what answer's right. It tells you sort of what questions were hard. I find that useful for knowing whether I should review things or not, especially on the post quizzes. Okay. So the quizzes include single response answers and multiple choice, and select all that apply answers. For select all that apply, each answer option is basically one question divided up evenly. For multiple choice, it's all or nothing. So that's how the quiz system works. And as I said, once you start, you have a time limit. And that timer will continue from when you start. So if you lose your network connection, you can go back and your timer is still running. You can check your answers if you decide an hour later, oh, that wasn't right. You're still in the time limit. You can fix it. Also, there's a closing date on the quiz. The closing date overrides the time limit. So if you start the quiz 5 minutes before the closing time, you have 5 minutes. Probably don't do that, especially since we will close our quizzes 15 minutes before this class starts. And I would not like to have people in front of me doing the quiz, which is why it closes before this class starts. Okay, so that's on the quizzes. And the first quiz is released tonight, due before class on Tuesday. And it's on the reading. I have put the reading on the quiz description that might be covered on the quiz. Okay, so any questions on that? Yes?
Are you required to write comments?
So the question is, are you required to write comments? Absolutely not. The main purpose of the comments is that if you think the question has multiple interpretations, please write a comment for that, rather than like trying to clarify with us within 90 minutes. Just write a comment saying, this is how I interpreted it. For things like that, that's the big thing they're for, is that if you think we wrote a bad question, that's how you fix it, rather than trying to clarify with us. Yeah? So the question is, are quizzes open note and open book? Yeah, we're not going to require you to not, they're open note, open book, open internet. Do not consult with other students. Do not write questions on Stack Overflow, you know, etc. But you can use normal resources.
Yeah. What's the subject matter
of the post quizzes?
The
post quizzes will be on stuff we talked about in lecture that week and possibly stuff that happened in the lab. Other questions? Okay, so that's that piece of logistics. Okay, so now that we've done that, let's move on to some more C, since I believe we finished up talking about TAR and TAP completion we mentioned last time as a thing you might find useful. So I'm going to talk about a few things in C which are different from C++. So one of these is how structs work. So in C++, a struct is a class where everything is public. That's what it is. In C, there are no classes, but there are structs which cannot have member functions. They just have member variables. There's no private. They're always public. That's what they are. And you'll notice here, I've declared struct rational. And to use it, I said struct rational and my variable name, in this case, 2.5. You might say, well, can't I just omit the struct like we're used to doing in C++? And in C, that is not allowed. If you do that, that is a syntax error. So you might say, that seems awfully inconvenient. I don't like writing struct space all the time. It's going to make my code really ugly. So if you don't like that, there's a C and C++ feature you can use called typedef. So for example, if you give one of the common uses, maybe you want to declare a bunch of unsigned ints, and you don't like typing unsigned int A, unsigned int B, unsigned int C, and so on. What you can do instead is you can write this typedef and say, hey, I'd like to make uint a new name for unsigned int. That's what that says. Basically, you take something where you declare a variable called uint and put typedef in front of it, and that says that's a new name for the type. And then after doing that, I can write uint A, uint B, uint C instead of unsigned int. Yes?
Does that work the same as macros? Like it just replaces it?
So the question is, does this work the same as macros? So it's similar, but it's not a text replacement. So this is actually a new type, but like in context where it's not, where it might matter whether or not it's a text replacement, it's not. Which I don't know of like common cases where that comes up, but for the most part, it works more like you expect than macros do. Because that's usually where it comes up that macros are really text replacement. Like if you have a plus sign in your typedef, like it's not going to work. So, other questions? Or I guess the most notable way in which it's not like a text replacement is that it's valid to do something like typedef. Array of 10 and then declare an array of 10x that way, which you obviously couldn't do with a text replacement. Not that I recommend doing this. I would, in fact, recommend not doing that. Use a struct if that's what you're thinking of doing. So, but the reason I'm mentioning typedefs is because these are really useful with structs because a lot of people don't like this style. Some people prefer it, and they want to type something shorter, so they'll do something like this. They'll define a struct, and then they'll typedef the struct to the shorter name where they don't have to type struct all the time. And after they do that, just like we saw with writing uint instead of unsigned int, they can just type rational every single time. Okay, that makes sense. My mic went out. That seems likely. Okay. I'm probably not worth trying to do a battery substitution now, so I'll try to speak louder. Okay, so by doing this typedef here, we just shorten our code and arguably make it more readable. So this is a common style you see. And you might say, well, this is awfully annoying. I have to write this other name twice. I have this extra code, can we make this shorter? And there's a common way you can make it shorter, which you will commonly see, which is probably a syntax you didn't expect to work. So here, I have the code before. It turns out that this semicolon here, before it, you can put declarations of instances of this struct. So you could declare a variable of this struct by putting it like an x before that, and that would make an instance of the struct called x as a global variable. And if you put rational after it, that would make an instance called rational. If you put typedef before that, that makes it not an instance, but a new name for the type. So there's this other syntax which declares a new name for the type all in one line of code. And I'm mentioning this not because I think this is a great idea, but because this is very common in real C code. So you'll see it all the time. Now, a problem that we have here is that we still have two names for the type. We have the name struct other name for rational and rational. And you might say, we don't really care about the struct version. I never want to write struct to use this. So can I just get rid of that? And the answer is yes. You can just not name it in the struct with the struct, but still have a typedef work. And you'll commonly see this in C code. It's not how I write C code, but it's very common, so you should expect to find it. Okay, so questions on this? Okay, so a note about this, since it's commonly asked, that after you do these two declarations, or one of the shorthands I showed you for them, you can declare a variable with the struct version and the name after struct, or the typedef version. You can't mix and match. They are separate sets of names. Okay, so any questions here? Yeah.
Are you allowed to name the typedef and the original struct the same name?
The question is, could I use the same name for both? The answer is yes, and you will sometimes see that in real code. I'm going to try to avoid it because I think it's confusing, but it's a thing people do. Okay, so a note about structs. Since many of you are probably most used to Java, you might be used to thinking of, oh, an instance of a class or a struct or something like that is a reference. They aren't in C++ or C. So this means if I declare this struct triple here, and I assign everything to 3, and I make a copy bar, that copy is a copy, not a reference to foo. And on the stack, we're going to have 2 copies of A, B, and C for these. Okay. So many people ask, I like being able to write triple foo instead of struct triple foo. Why would anyone even bother with the other syntax? There's one important case you'll see in practice where it comes up where you kind of want the other name, and it's the easiest way to declare a struct which references itself. So here, I can't write list star next because I can't use the name list until after the semicolon at the end of this declaration. Because it's not, that alias doesn't exist yet. So to write it this way, I have to write struct list underscore t to make the pointer for our classical linked list.
How would you do it if you've chosen not to give a name to the struct at all?
So the question is, how would I do it if I chose not to give a name to the struct at all? I don't believe you can. So you have to give some sort of name at some point. Other questions? Yeah. Could the question is, could the struct names be list? Yes. As I said, I'm using a different name for the struct and its typedef, just so it's clear that they're different. Other questions? Okay. So this is our classic linked list, and if we want to make that in C, we're gonna use malloc because there's no new in C. And malloc takes an argument, which is the size of the thing to allocate. Typically, you'll use the size of operator to get that rather than trying to figure out how much space the compiler is gonna use for an integer and a pointer by yourself. And then you can assign to that. And just like you use delete in C++, we have free, which you can use to undo what malloc did and should do, because leaky memory is something we want to avoid in all of our code. Okay. So any questions about this? Okay. And since we're talking about malloc and free, I mentioned that in C, these are the functions we use for dynamic arrays. So we don't have the new array syntax that you're used to in C++. Instead, you malloc, and you just supply a size that's big enough for the array you want, and you get a pointer to the first element of that allocation, and you use pointer arithmetic to navigate through that set of bytes you get allocated. And because you use malloc to allocate this, you can use free to deallocate it. Unlike C++, there's not two versions of delete to worry about. Any questions about this? Okay, so these are the two things that get people the most about differences between C and C++. Just wanted to review them for that reason, since I assume if you remember things from 2150, it's probably the C++ things and not the C things. Okay, so some other little notes on things that happen in C and C++ which are surprising. So one thing is going to be about signed and unsigned types. You probably remember vaguely that there's this notion of unsigned types. The idea is just that they don't have a sign bit, which means that they only hold non-negative numbers. And for the most part, they do what you expect. It happens that you can use multiple names. You can write unsigned instead of unsigned int. You can explicitly write signed, though you'll rarely see that happen. You have these types, and I'm giving the ranges on our lab machines. They might be different on other machines. So one thing which is not intuitive is the result of this. So if you look at this code, you're saying, well, we're comparing -1 and 0. -1 is less than 0. This code should print out true. We know true in C is represented as the value 1. So it should print out 1. And every time you run this, it's guaranteed to print out 0 on our department machines. Might say, well, that seems silly. So basically, the rule you should have in mind is don't compare signed and unsigned numbers and expect negative values to work. If you care, the simplest solution is to pass both things to a type which can hold all the possible values, in this case, like a long. And that will always give the correct results. As for why does this happen? Well, C has very precise rules about how to do comparisons between two integers. And the rules are that you convert the two values to the same type. And you say, well, that sounds great, so we'll convert them both to long because we're comparing an int and an unsigned int. And that would make sense, but that's not what the rules say. The rules say that you convert them to an int if all possible values fit, which they don't in this case. Otherwise, you convert them to the type of one of the operands, not a bigger type. And that's where we get in trouble. So the compiler ends up choosing to convert both of the values to an unsigned int, and we get the wrong result for the comparison because of this bad rule in the C standard, which they're not going to change because they're worried that they're going to break some code somewhere if they fix it. So I'm mentioning this. The short for you is just if you care about comparing signed and unsigned cast. And also, this is a good reason to turn on things like compiler warnings to tell you that you're doing this and you'll get in trouble. Any questions about this? Okay, so since I'm talking about rules in C, we should talk about like what C is. So many languages, like sort of Python, are more defined by one big dominant implementation, and that's essentially what the language is. C is not in that sort of camp. So like originally, there was a version of C, and the authors of the original C wrote a book. And that was considered sort of the description of what C was. And eventually, a lot of people wanted to implement C, and they wanted their implementations to do the same thing. So they came together and came up with a standard. So the American National Standards Institute in 1989 published a version of C that multiple compilers could implement, and it was specified by this one document that everyone agreed would be what their compilers would do. And this is called C89. It's sometimes called C90 because the International Standards Organization standardized it a year later. And in GCC and Clang, if you provide the option minus NC or minus standard equals C90, you're telling the compiler, hey, I want to use this version of C. Follow the rules as written as close as possible. And this is the version which looks mostly like modern C. So most of what you're used to in C is all in C89. If you look at code from the original version of the C programming language, you'll probably be very confused. Like, why are all the function declarations so silly? I didn't know you could declare arguments after the parentheses. Things that we don't do anymore. And they've continued to update these standards. So the most notable update was in C99, which was in 1999, which you can request with standard equals C99. It adds things that you probably use all the time and thought were always features of C, like / comments. They weren't in C90. And declaring variables in the middle of a block that is not just after a set of braces. That was also not supported in C90. And they've continued to update it. There's an update in 2011. And we mostly will not talk about things beyond features you thought were in every single version of C that are in anything after C90. Except to note that they exist. But these define the rules for what C does. And compilers, modern compilers especially, try very hard to follow those rules. But those rules often don't specify things you'd think they'd specify. Usually it's not in the same way as the signed versus unsigned comparison, where the rules basically say you have to give the wrong result. But they often just underspecify things. So one example is here. So who can tell me what should this code output? And tell me why you think it should output that. And if you don't know, int max is the maximum possible value for a signed integer. Yes. Zero. Why zero? Because of integer overflow. So you're saying that int max plus one should be something very small, and that shouldn't be greater than int max. Yeah, so that's a reasonable thing to think. And if you compile without optimizations on my system, you get that answer. And if you compile with more optimizations, you don't. And according to the C standard, these are both correct. And if you want to see the reason why, here's the two versions of the code. So we have the unoptimized code. So first we use LEA to add one to number, put that in EAX. Then we compare EAX and EDI, so the added one version and the non-added one version. We use this set L instruction, which reads from the condition codes and uses that to set its argument. And we expand that 1 byte register into the full 32 bits for the return value. So that's the code you'd expect it. With more optimizations, my compiler decides to be clever. It says, oh, well, number plus one is always greater than number. I'm just going to just return one, don't need to do this expensive comparison that's always true. And you might say, well, that's wrong. It's not always true. We could have overflow. Well, the authors of the C standard made a decision, and that decision was compilers shouldn't have to worry about overflow most of the time. Because it makes optimizations like this a whole lot easier. If you had to worry about overflow all the time, like in less trivial cases, like where this was in the middle of a loop somewhere, you couldn't do this. And so they wanted to give room for compilers to take advantage of that. So they invented this notion of undefined behavior. And so what they said for undefined behavior was compilers, they can do whatever they want for this. And one of the cases for undefined behavior is if you have signed integer overflow. You take your signed int and you wrap around. They say, we don't specify that it has to wrap around. The compiler can do whatever. So, and you saw an example here where the compiler, you know, just ignored that overflow might occur and optimized the code anyways. And the compiler can also do other unexpected things. So like, in addition to like deciding to give any answer to that comparison, it could have crashed the program. That is a valid response. So your compiler could decide, rather than integer overflow wrapping around, it's going to cause your program to segfault. You might consider that useful, you might not. And there's a whole bunch of things in C which are undefined behavior. So one of them is signed integer overflow and underflow. This is only signed. Unsigned does what you expect, but signed does not. Out of bounds pointers. If you have a pointer outside of an array and try to use it, that's undefined behavior. So that's kind of expected. You expect that to segfault, but it doesn't have to segfault. The compiler can do whatever they want. So like they can at compile time notice, oh, this goes out of the array, I'm just not going to generate the code for it and not segfault. Integer divide by zero is another example. Writing read-only data. And we'll talk about something called an out-of-bounds shift later today or next time. So these are undefined behavior. And as I said, one of the reasons for it is flexibility for optimization. So that they don't want to constrain the compiler to have to check, can this overflow the signed integer all the time? Another reason is that different architectures work differently anyways. So they want to let the compiler do what's natural on that system. So if an architecture, for example, in a divide by zero just gives the wrong answer versus causing the program to crash, they want the compiler to just generate the fastest code and not worry about it, rather than always producing a crash or always producing a particular answer or something like that. Yeah?
So whose responsibility is this to handle the hardware or operating system?
So the question is whose responsibility to handle this is? So undefined behavior is just a license for compilers to generate whatever code they like in those cases. As far as who handles it, practically speaking, as a programmer, you don't want your code to do this because when you change your compiler version or your optimization options, suddenly your code is giving different answers.
So no one is handling that. Is it just programmers' responsibility?
Because it's not. So the question is for handling this, it's program. So if you want to not avoid the bad effects of undefined behavior, it's you as a programmer need to handle it, as a C programmer. As far as what the compiler is concerned, it's just making the compiler's job easier because the compiler can do whatever it likes for undefined behavior. It doesn't need to actually do anything extra. Yeah. So the question is, this one of the reasons they say C and C++ is faster than Python or Java? Some people might say that, but it's probably not on the top 10 list. Like, there are languages which are closer to the assembly without having this sort of undefined behavior. And there are varying opinions about whether this was a good design decision. But it's what we have in the C standard. Okay, so before I move on from C, I'd like to give one final note on things with the command line. And that's about manual pages for library functions. So we've used printf, and you might say, where can I look up what printf does? Well, there's a man page for it. So you'd say, okay, let's look up the manual page for printf, and you'll get this. This doesn't look like the manual page for a C function, and in fact isn't. There's a command line tool called printf. So that's unfortunate. Now, if you remember when we looked at man, when we went down to the examples, there was this option, man-a, display all of the manual pages with that name. So we're going to use that, and maybe there's also a manual page for the printf C function. So I do man minus a printf. So first, I get the user command, and I'm going to press Q to quit, like it says on the bottom, because I don't want this one. And it's going to ask me, next, it's showing me printf in section 3, and press return to view. That looks better. So this is the manual page for printf. I think you, so did you see printf in 2150? Raise it, show of hands. Yes? Okay. So you've seen it before. This is the manual page if you want to look up, like, how do I format things? It's all in here. You might find a quicker reference for common tasks, but here it is. One thing I would like to point out that is probably missed in 2150 a lot is that you can use %p to print out a pointer, which is really handy. Since I think often that doesn't come up when people go over strings and numbers and so. Good. Oh. That's here. Okay. How about that? So any C questions before we talk about our next topic? Or man page questions? Okay. So next we're going to talk about something known as bitwise operators, but first I'm going to introduce this with a problem that you can solve without anything you don't already know. And that's that given OXAB, I want a function which will return OXA. And the same thing for other things in place of A and B, other hexadecimal digits. So I want to extract the top nibble. We call hexadecimal digits nibbles, half of a byte. So what's some C code I can use to do this? And you don't need anything you don't use all the time to do this. And maybe it would help to remember that this OXA is the A times 16 to the 1 plus B times 16 to the 0, just by how bases work. And someone have an answer? Over there? Divide by 16? Exactly. That is a way you should all know about to do it. And the way division works in C is that it rounds down, or rounds to zero, actually, which is exactly what you want in this case because we have an unsigned char as our value. And we don't need to worry about anything after, before the A because it's a byte, so there's only two hexadecimal digits. So that's exactly code that would work. So that all of you should know, like, how to write this. Maybe you need more time to think about it, but stuff you've done before, you've probably divided in code before. So division is really useful, and in fact, we have instructions to do it. And on typical machines, division, relatively speaking, is really slow. So on the Intel Skylake set of processors. This is a design of processors that includes my desktop. Each division is about 6 cycles. For comparison, the same machine can perform 4 additions per cycle. So if we think about it this way, the division is 24 times slower than addition. And it's actually worse if we're talking about 8-byte division and not single byte division. And this is just what the timing is. And there's an observation you can make that, well, this is actually a special case where we can do something simpler than division if we were using hardware. That if we think about how this value is going to be represented in hardware, that the operation we're doing is really a lot simpler. So I have my 2 hexadecimal digits, and you might remember a trick that sometimes comes up in 2150 that you can divide each set of 4 bits to make 1 hexadecimal digit. So it happens that here I have, this is my 7, this is my 2, and that works out because this whole 7 here is being multiplied by 16 by being this many place bits over in the number. And if we had another place, it would be multiplied by 16 squared and so on. And this means that the operation I'm doing is actually just taking these high bits and extracting them. And in our machine, these are just going to be on wires where we use typically voltage to represent whether it's 0 or 1. And we just want to take some of the wires we're using to represent this 8-bit value. We'll have 8 of them. We just want 4 of them. And that's free. Like in hardware, this is literally we just cut some wires and we're done. You know, we aren't actually doing any work, certainly no computation. So it's much, much simpler than division. But the problem is that we can't really expose the just take some of the wires operation directly in assembly because, well, you know, we can't get a 4-bit output in assembly. We don't have a 4-bit register. We don't want to add registers, a 3, a 4, a 5, a 6, you know, for all the possibilities. So we can't really expose this directly, so we're going to expose a related operation in order to let people do this, you know, efficient operation of let's just get a few bits and let's just move bits around and expose that, well, in hardware that's really easy to do, so we should make it convenient in assembly because it's a very efficient thing for us to implement in hardware. That also might be useful because if you want to print out hexadecimal numbers, sure is useful to get each one at a time, for example. So any questions so far? I know this is the first time we're talking about values on wires, really, which we'll talk about more later. So here, I'm just saying, we have bundles of wires for a multi-bit value. That's going to be our pattern, and this is going to come up a lot more later on in the semester. Okay, so x86 has a way of exposing this, which is the shift right instruction. And what the shift right instruction does is it moves over the bits of a value certain number of bits, so basically just wiring up between the input and the output kind of like this. We think of the value as a collection of wires. Now, we have a bit of a problem with this, which is that, well, our output register is not going to just be 4 bits shorter. We need to put something here. So the question is, what is that? And there's multiple choices we could have for that. And the choice that the SHR instruction does is put zeros in. Because we have to put something there, well, we just put zeros. Okay, so questions about this operation? Okay, so that's our shift operation. And we can use that to implement our get top nibble function that we shift over by 4 the value. This is example code, but we'll do it, where we're just taking care of the argument being an unsigned char. So we first move it from a 8-bit register to a 32-bit register. And then shift by 4. It happens that zeros in the top bits is exactly what we want. We don't, that's how the same is going to have the same effect as division and rounding down. And this instruction is a lot simpler in hardware than division because we don't have to worry about dividing by like 7, where we're going to have to do a lot of math. Okay. So questions on this assembly? Okay. So it turns out that you can ask for this directly in C. Because this shift operator is so useful, we actually have a way of writing it explicitly in C. And that's with this greater than operator. This operator you may have seen also used for Cin in C++. It turns out it was originally there for shift. And so this is a way of writing this get top nibble operation without a division. We're just going to move over 4 bits, discarding the lower 4 bits, just like that picture I had, just like if we cut those wires. And we need to put something in the top, so we're going to put in zeros, which is going to be exactly what we want to not have it affect the value. So any questions on this? Okay. So you might say, okay, so I should write this way to make my code fast rather than doing the division version. And that's a reasonable thought. But with a modern compiler, probably doesn't matter if you turn on optimizations, because compilers know this too. They know, oh, I can divide by a constant using the shift operator and it's faster. I'm just going to do that. They have that rule embedded in there. So they'll do that for you. You can write whatever you think is convenient for the most part. They obviously are not going to do this if we were not dividing by the constant 16, but dividing by like some global variable. They're probably not going to figure out that that global variable can be turned into a shift. But where it's a constant, that's an easy, they just have some rules about, oh, you can turn these into this faster operator, which is a shift. So any questions on this? Yeah.
So if you were to shift a negative signed integer, you would not get the same value?
So the question is, what happens for a negative integer? We will get to that later. It is an important question, and I've carefully avoided that here by having the value be an unsigned char. So with positive integers, we can think of the right shift operation as just another version of dividing by 2. So one way of thinking about it is how it changes the bits. It moves the bits over and adds some zeros. Another way is just as dividing by 2 and rounding down. Or dividing by a power of 2, so 2 multiple times and rounding down. Okay, so any questions on this? Okay, so I mentioned we get to what happens with negative values later. So let's start with this. So here I have a function that uses the SHR operator. And if we pass minus 2 to it, and remember that this is our EDI is our argument, and EAX is our return value. What's the answer going to be? And I'll give you a minute to figure out what it should be. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, okay, and H? Okay, so most people think it's F, which is what I agree with. So who can tell me, does anyone tell me what, exactly what large positive number it would be? Ben, it's a large positive number. Yeah. Okay, so you think it's going to be 0, 1, 1, 1, and all 1s? And 1, 0? Okay. So that's what your guess. And how did you figure that out? Have one, so we start with?
Like 1 and then
0. Okay, so we start with 1 and 0, 0, 1.
The 1, 1 at the beginning for the sign.
Yeah. This is the number we start with, you say? 1s and?
Like 1 and then 0, 0.
Okay, so you're saying 1 and 0, 0. Oh, right, so we're starting with?
Sign bit,
okay. So this is the number we start with? What? Okay, so someone else? Yeah.
Is it 2 to the 31 minus 1?
So you're saying 2 to the 31 minus 1? Okay, and that in fact is this number. So I agree with your answer, but let's talk about how we get there. So this involves remembering 2's complement. May have thought you escaped ever needing to know 2's complement again. Unfortunately, it's not how it works. So we start with 2, which in binary is that. And remember to turn it to 2's complement. We're going to flip all the bits and add 1. So negative 2 is going to be all 1's, then 0, 1, this plus 1. So we're going to end up with all 1's, and then 1, 1, 0. Sorry, which means that, in fact, it was this number. So 2, yeah, it's 1. So then we shift this over by 1, which is what this does. We're going to get all 1's with a 0 at the beginning, because that's what gets shifted in. And that's going to be, in fact, 2 to the 31 minus 1. So another way, so for helping reviewing 2's complement, so I think most people end up remembering the flip all bits and add one rule. Another way you can think about it is that you can draw the 2's complement numbers as a wheel. We have 0, and each time we do this, we get plus 1. We take negative 1, we add 1, we advance around, and we have our case where we take our most positive number and add 1 and get our most negative number. That's another way of remembering it. A third way of remembering it is you can think of 2's complement as having a negative 2 to the 31's place in place of the as the sign bit, and that's the effect on the value. But however you remember it, whether it's the flip all the bits and add 1, so on, you know, you get to the conclusion that when you manipulate the bits like this, we change the sign bit to 0, so we're going to get a positive number. And if you remember that just that we did the flip all the bits operation to negate 2, that means we have all these 1's in our bits, so it's going to be a large positive number. And that was how I expected people to answer this question. So any questions on figured out the value? So the actual value is, in fact, is 2 to the 31 minus 1, or this all 0 and all 1's. In this case. Any questions? Yeah?
So when you do a shift right, does it always default to putting a 0 in the left?
So the question is, when you do a shift right, does it always default to putting a 0 in there? We'll get to that later. The SHR instruction always does that. That's how the instruction works. Okay, so there might be a question of what else could we put in there? And we can make this observation that, well, in this case, we can observe that the answer we kind of wanted was this negative 1. So how do we get negative 1? What are we missing to have negative 1? And if we look at our 2's complement numbers, negative 1 is just opposite here. It just has a different sign bit. That it would be the same thing if we just set the sign bit to 1 instead of 0. And you might say, is this true in general? And one way of thinking about it is, let's use our flip all the bits and add 1 procedure to divide by 2. So if I start with a negative value, first I'm going to get the positive value. So I'm going to flip all the bits and add 1 to get x. Then I'm going to right shift to do the divide by 2, and we know that works because that's just moving over one bit in place and the 2 to the 0 and so on. I'm going to flip all the bits and add 1 to get my actual answer. So this is a way we could divide by 2, what we're expecting. And if you think about what we're doing, this right shift by 1 and then flipping all the bits, it means that instead of shifting in zeros, we're going to end up shifting in ones, effectively. That's what flipping the bits after the right shift does. It means the new things we have, instead of being 0, they're going to end up as 1 in the answer. And that means that if we shift over and add ones instead of zeros for this negative number, we'll get the right answer, except for this adding 1 stuff. But except for that, as long as that doesn't matter, we would actually get the right answer by just shifting in ones instead of a 0 for negative numbers. So except for some rounding issues, and we'll talk about what the rounding ends up being in a bit, that we could also divide negative numbers by 2 if we just didn't always shift in zeros. So any questions on this idea? And this is useful enough that x86 has an instruction for it called SAR for arithmetic shift right. So we're going to call the shift zeros is going to be a logical, and the shift 1 or 0 is going to be in arithmetic. These are vocab terms you'll see everywhere, not just in the x86 instruction set for these. And what the arithmetic right shift is going to do, it is going to, instead of shifting in zeros, it's going to copy the sign bit, copy the top bit for when it shifts in. So if we start out with a positive number, we're going to shift in zeros. If we start out with a negative number, we're going to shift in ones. So we have those two possibilities. We just copy the sign bit instead of actually always shifting in zeros. So questions on what I have here? Okay, so you might say, okay, this is a useful instruction. How do I access it in C? Can I do the same sort of thing and access it? If so, how would the C compiler decide whether to use, which version to use? And the answer is that the shift operator we showed you does both of these. And the compiler chooses based on the types you provide. If it's unsigned, it's going to do the logical shift. If it's signed, it's going to do the arithmetic shift. Okay. So on RX86 machines, you can get either of these. You just need to specify the right types as your arguments to shift. Okay. Any questions here? Sense. Okay, so I'm actually simplifying a bit. So we talked about C standards earlier, and an ugliness of the C standard is that I'm telling you that, oh, it does an arithmetic shift when you do the sign shift. That's not actually required by the standard. The standard says that a signed right shift is what is known as implementation defined. And what that means in this case is the standard tells compilers you can do either an arithmetic shift or a logical shift in that case, but you need to document which one you do. In practice, I do not know of any x86 compiler or really any other compiler which doesn't do an arithmetic shift for signed values, so you can pretty much rely on it, but it's not actually required. And I assume the only reason they did this is for architectures which have forgotten to provide an arithmetic shift instruction. So there's another thing about shifts in C, which is that you would assume that if you do something like x shifted over 64, where x is a long, that the answer is going to be 0. But the C standard has said the result of that is undefined behavior. You might say, why did they do that? That seems awfully inconvenient. Shouldn't it just shift off all the values and we should get 0 or all ones if it's a negative value? And the reason for this is that many machines like x86, when you do a variable shift, they only use the lower bits of the shift amount. So if you move 64 into CL and then shift by CL a value, this is going to shift by 0 on x86. And it shifts by 0 because this shift right, uses only lower 5 bits of the shift amount. Only enough to represent 0 to 63. So the reaction of the C standard people to that is, we don't want compilers to have to check if the shift amount's in range, so they can do whatever they want. And in practice, compilers will do things like generate exactly this code, and then you'll find out x shifted over 64 is x. Even though that doesn't make any sense. So just don't shift by more than the size of a type. Okay, any questions on standards here? Okay, so now that we have our arithmetic shift. What's the result here? This is another case where you might need to use some 2's complement knowledge. Oh, we'll call this F and G then. Who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks it's A? B? C? D? E? F? Okay, G? Okay, so we have a split of answers, which is interesting. So for figuring this out, the first thing I want to do is figure out what's minus 6 in binary. So we're going to take 6, which is going to be lots of zeros, and then we have 1, 1, 0, 4's place, 2's place, 1's place. That's 6. And we want to flip all the bits. So we'll flip the bits to get all 1's, then 0, 0, 1. We'll add 1 to that. We'll get 0, 1, 0, 1, and all 1's. Okay, so that's minus 6 in 2's complement binary. And then I want to do the shift operation. And this is going to be an arithmetic shift. So we're going to copy this 1 here. So we're going to start with 3 1's at the beginning and what we shift. And then we just discard these 2 values. So we end up with 3 1's, all 1's, and then 1, 0. So then our question is, what is that value? And this value here, we can figure that out by flipping all the bits and adding 1 to negate it into its complement. So if we flip all the bits of this, we get all 0's. and then a 1, and we add 1, and we get 2. So this is negative 2. Yes?
How do you know that it's going to preserve the 1 when it didn't last time?
So how do we know it's going to preserve the 1? Because I just told you that on our machines, this generates the arithmetic version. Because we have a signed int here. And that's the same thing that's true here. So if I had an unsigned int, it wouldn't do that. But on the other hand, our argument wouldn't be really -6. So any questions on this, or concerns that I worked something out wrong? Okay. So something to note here is that without rounding, our expectation was that this would be kind of like x divided by 4. But if I do -6 divided by 4, what result do I expect? What should the result of -6 divided by 4 in C be? Who remembers how division in C works? Which is the same as division in Java. Yeah?
-1.
And the reason for this is that we have the result for this is 3/2. And the rule is that we round towards 0. But we see that this does not round towards 0. And that's where our dividing -2 except for rounding comes in, that the rounding is different. And in fact, what happens is that an arithmetic shift rounds towards negative infinity. It always rounds down. But in C, our division operator rounds towards 0. Or truncates is another way of looking at it. We write the decimal number, remove everything after the decimal point. Now, this doesn't mean that compilers can't use the shift operator to generate division by unsigned numbers, and they will do that. So if you write, in this case, this is going to be int divide by 8, and x return x divided by 8. This is the code that at least one version of GCC generates with some optimization flags. Is that it uses an arithmetic shift, but it adjusts the number based on whether it's signed or not in order to fix the rounding. And doing this is probably still faster than using the divide operator. Even with the 3 extra instructions to fix the rounding by adjusting the number before doing the wrongly rounded division. Okay. Okay. I have one. So any questions on this? So I have one more minute, and we can introduce our next topic. So the other side of shifting is we learned about shifting to remove bits. Another thing you might want to do is move a number, move a nibble into, say, the top part of a byte. And in hardware, this is really easy. We can just add some zeros to the end, just have some wires with no voltage on them. We're done. In software, we can do this by multiplying. That's the simple way of doing it. But multiplying, it's not as expensive as division, not even close, but it's still not ideal. We'd like to really expose this shifting bits operation in the same way. And you might say, well, maybe you can just pass a negative number. Sorry, not supported, even though that would make sense. Instead, we have a shift left operation, which is going to be basically just the opposite. It's always going to shift in zeros because we don't have a sign case to worry about. And that's all I have for today.